why are the beaches in Mumbai so dirty and the beaches abroad are clean? I was having a conversation with my mother regarding the same. I was basically ranting that, you know, mom, nobody's, you know, cleaning up the beaches in Mumbai. My mom at the end of the conversation simply said that, you know, if you think the beach isn't clean, just go and clean it. It's as simple as that. So we organized a cleanup from Prabhadevi to Mahim, which is a stretch of 4 kilometers. We had a turnout of around 1300 volunteers from 20 colleges. So we cleaned around 25 tons of trash on single day in an hour.
What's the hardest part about cleaning a beach?
The hardest part is basically surviving, getting volunteers consistently, doing cleanups every weekend.
Once you collect this massive amount of trash, where does that go?
So unfortunately, all the waste that we collect at the cleanups, it goes to the landfills. Now, a lot of people also criticize this, saying that you're picking up trash from one place and putting it somewhere else, which is absolutely true, but this is the best thing we can do. Every cleanup drive, we collect around 10,000 kgs of trash. Let's not consider saving the environment. We need to save ourselves.
Welcome to Sustainability with Shreya Malhar. Thank you so much for being here today. You're an incredible environmentalist. I know you're the founder of Beach Please, which is India's largest youth-led community working towards environmental preservation, primarily through cleanups. Please tell me about where this all started.
So I always say this thing that I'm an accidental environmentalist. I never planned to be an environmentalist. So my journey dates back to July 2017 when I'd been to Bali on a vacation with my friends. I was 19 years old back then, and it was like my first international trip with my friends. When I went to Bali, I noticed that the Bali has very beautiful beaches and it's known for its beaches. I also did a couple of activities like scuba diving, snorkeling, and I realized that I had a connection with the ocean there.
Was that the first time you felt like you had a connection with the ocean?
Yes, because if you've done scuba diving, you realize when you go inside the ocean, you can actually hear yourself breathing inside. And I think I've never felt something like that before. So when I came back to Mumbai, I think it was during Ganesh Utsav, I was strolling at the beach, at the Dadar beach. And the state in which I saw the beach was really very disturbing. I could only see plastic waste accumulated on the beach, which triggered a question in my mind that why are the beaches in Mumbai so dirty and the beaches abroad are clean? So I went back home, I was having a conversation with my mother regarding the same. I was basically ranting that, you know, mom, nobody's, you know, cleaning up the beaches in Mumbai. Look at the beaches abroad, you know, there's so much of tourism happening there. Here, nobody, you know, cares about the beaches. Whereas Mumbai is the financial capital of India. It's not that we don't have the resources.
Right. So, but had you noticed this difference before? Had you noticed how unclean the other beach was before growing up, before you went on that trip to Bali?
Yes, I had noticed it. But because of that trip, because of seeing the beautiful beaches in Bali, it made it more prominent for me, the difference. So basically, I was ranting for like 30 minutes. It went on, and my mom at the end of the conversation simply said that, you know, if you think the beach isn't clean, just go and clean it. It's as simple as that. And that's what I thought, you know, this is so motivating. I can actually do this. So
was that how you took it? That was motivating? Because a lot of times we get told this and, you know, the task seems so monumental and so big, like who am I to do this alone, right?
No, because initially when I thought of cleaning the beach, I thought that I would clean the beach once and it would stay clean forever. And my mom even till date says that that's the only thing that I've actually, you know, listened to whatever she said. I called up a few of my school friends. I told them about this idea of cleaning up the beach and I got a good response from them. But the first guy I called up, my school friend, so we were doing CA back then. I was giving my foundation course exam, which is basically level one exam. And I'd already failed two attempts.
So you'd failed two attempts?
Yes. This was September 2017. In the month of November, December, we had the next attempt. I called him up. I was like, bro, you know, let's do a cleanup. This is what I want to do and that. He's like, don't you want to study? Don't you want to clear your attempts? You have already failed twice. You know, I'm not going to come for this shit and this and that. And I was really demotivated by that. But then I called a couple of my other friends and, you know, 20 of them actually turned up for the cleanup. And surprisingly, this guy who said that he wouldn't turn up for the cleanup drive also showed up. And I asked him, like, why did you show up for the cleanup? He's like, bhai ne bola na, to jana to padega.
Nice. Is that how you get all the other people to join you as well? It's
I think so, because I think it was just mere friendship. He didn't even know what you were exactly going to do. He did not believe in the idea of cleaning up the beach. But just because I asked him to show up, he turned up at the beach. We cleaned a stretch of the beach and we went home, you know. And that was like a mini school reunion for us. When I came back the next day at the beach again, I realized that there was more waste on the beach. That's when I...
After you cleaned up.
After
the first
I
day.
Cleaned up. That's when I realized with every high tide, there is more waste that comes to the beach.
So more waste that comes to the beach from where?
From the ocean. The ocean keeps puking waste at the beach during high tides. So basically, there's a study which says that out of the total waste that gets into the ocean, only 5% of it comes back to the beach. 1% floats on the ocean and the remaining 94% gets on the ocean bed.
gets inside the, like, it's
in the ocean,
literally
on the bed,
sinking. Okay.
Yes, which is almost impossible to remove. So, which is why with every high tide, there is more waste that comes and gets accumulated on the beaches. And that when they realized that, I thought, you know, I should do the cleanup once again. So next weekend we came, there were only four of us, including me, clearing a stretch of 4 kilometers.
What do you think happened in terms of the drop in numbers?
I think basically that the first experience was not very satisfying, or it was very, what do you say, hard work for them, because it's not easy cleaning the beach.
What's the hardest part about cleaning a beach?
If you ask me now, the hardest part is basically surviving, getting volunteers consistently, doing cleanups every weekend. But back then, since it was a second cleanup drive, I think picking up the trash under the sun on a beach is difficult. But after going through it for like almost 6 years, I've realized that is nothing. That's the easiest part. The most difficult part is consistently getting in volunteers for the cleanups.
Keeping the momentum going.
Exactly. Because if you do one cleanup drive or two cleanup drives in a month, it's easier to get volunteers. But when you're doing 10 to 12 cleanup drives every month for the last 6 years, consistently getting volunteers is always going to be a challenge. Second thing is funding the whole campaign. That is one of the major challenges. Third thing is, you know, coordinating with the bureaucrats, you know, getting your work done, getting things done from them is another challenge for us.
What do you mean talking to the bureaucrats?
Now, when I started in 2017, when I reached out to the, you know, the bureaucrats, the employees of the BMC, they never took me seriously because they thought, oh, this is a 19-year-old boy, you know, doing some college project, you know, he's going to disappear after a couple of weeks. It took us some serious 5 or 6 months to make them understand that we are down here for some serious business and we are not going to go until we clean the entire beach. So that was like a major challenge, because imagine now if you think about beach cleanups, it's relatively a known concept. People know about it, right? Back then, nobody knew about it.
That's the first thing people think about when you talk about, hey, let's do some environmentally friendly activity, even as a team, even as a company. I think cleanup is the first thing that comes to people's minds.
Because it's very trending right now. Back then, that wasn't the case. It was a relatively new concept. So, you know, going around, imagine a 90-year-old boy going around asking people to come and clean a beach. That was so unconventional. And people are like, are you mad? This is not our job. This is something which the authorities need to do or the government need to do. So changing the mindset, still getting volunteers was a task.
But you thought back then that this was your job. Like, did you at any point think, why am I doing this? Who am I? Like, I'm not the one littering it. I'm not the one throwing trash away. So why should I be the one cleaning it?
So honestly speaking, when I did my first cleanup drive, the whole experience was, something I'll always remember. It made me a calmer person because I've always been an aggressive kid. So when I went for the cleanup, it was like a therapy for me, you know, in a way that, you know, I had peace of mind. So as a kid, you know, I was this rebellious kid. You know, when you are in school, you have this one kid, your parents and teachers ask you to stay away from. I was that kid. I would bully other kids. I would go beating them up and all those things. Because there were issues at my home, because I had a separated family. Now when I look back at it, I understand. But when I was like 15, 16 years old, I did not understand what was happening with me.
So you were acting out based on whatever
yes.
you were going through.
Yes. So I was this aggressive kid. So when I started up with the cleanup drives, I realized that, you know, this is something that I'm liking. This is giving me a peace of mind. And that was the initial thought for a couple of weeks or months maybe. But then, you know, a lot of people started asking me that, you know, the beach isn't getting clean. We're just cleaning it today. Tomorrow, the high tide is getting back the same waste. What is the point of doing it? So I never had the goal or motivation to clean up the entire beach. That was never the primary motive. The motive was that I am trying to do something for my country, for my city, in whatever best capacity I can. Even if the beach doesn't get clean, it's fine. I will do whatever best I can for the country. That was whole about it.
And what do you think was the impact of that first cleanup?
Like I said, you know, like, it really made me happy. Like, I don't know, after a very long time, I went back home, I slept peacefully. I was proud of myself, like, even though nobody was, I was, because initially people have called me Kachrawala. People did not believe in the idea. But somewhere that made me happy. It made me proud of myself, you know. Even if you pick up one piece of trash from the beach or you pick up 10,000 pieces of trash from the beach, you're still doing something. And that was the same feeling which I had, you know, because till that date, I've always been an average kid. So I've never, got any kind of accolades or medals in schools. I was never a topper. I was always an average student. I've never got appreciation, you know, as such, as a student.
In an academic sense.
In an academics or, yeah, I was into sports. I used to play football, but not a best player, if you say, in the school or something like that. So I've never got that appreciation as a student, you know, whether it be in sports or in education, like in academics. So when I started this, I was like, this is my way of doing something for my country.
What was the vision that you had for Beach Please back then? Knowing that, you know, your mom just told you, hey, if you have a problem with something, solve it. To then you taking up the first beach cleanup. Where did you see this going back then compared to where it is now?
See, honestly, for the first year of the cleanups, I never had a goal. I never had a vision. I never wanted to change the world. I never wanted to start a community. My schedule was my friends and I, we would go out partying on Saturday nights, party till 6 in the morning, 8 o'clock directly go for the cleanup, do the cleanup, go home and sleep.
Have you done these cleanups being drunk?
Yes, I have. I have almost for a year I've done that. You know,
drunk beach cleanups.
Yes, and I've passed out at the beach once. And my friends were looking for me. Where have you passed out? So, you know, that's happened with me. So the whole idea was that was my weekend schedule. Second thing, whatever I did made me happy. You know, there was a satisfaction. I'm doing something for my city. That's all about it. It was eventually I realized that, you know, I thought that where does the waste come to the other beach from? Like, where does it come from? Then I realized it was through the Mithi River. The Mithi River is the source of the waste. And it's one of the most vital rivers for Mumbai.
Okay.
When I realized that, I switched from Dadar to Mithi River. So we stopped doing
that
Dadar Beach
source.
Cleanups. Yeah, that was the source. So we stopped doing cleanups at Dadar Beach and we moved to the Mithi River. And that was a difficult challenge because if you look at the Mithi River, it took me 4 months to convince my own team to start a cleanup drive. Why? Because if you look at it, there were layers and layers of plastic waste. If you look at the before picture, we have removed almost 6 million kgs of waste from the bank of the Mithi River.
What does this plastic waste look like? What is the biggest... what's the biggest plastic waste that you find there in terms of, is it bottles, is it wrappers, is it, what do you find most often?
I think everything that you use at your households, we find at the cleanup drives. But the most prominent type of waste is single-use plastics and MLPs, which is the packaging. Yeah. Second thing is clothing. Third is clothing.
So clothes in proper condition.
Some of them are in proper condition, some of them are torn. We also find furniture. We have removed sofa sets from the cleanup. We have found a scooter at the cleanup, which was dumped in the river.
People dump scooters and furnitures in the river?
Yes, because if you have to discard a furniture, you have to give it to the municipal authority and they charge you for that. So the best way to, you know, to discard it and save money is to dump it in the river. That's how people think. We have found sanitary napkins, used syringes,
Medical waste,
which is a bigger challenge for us. During COVID, we found 14 bags filled with used COVID antigen test kits. So we have found that. We have also found, so there's this concept called as ghost net, if you know what ghost nets are. It's basically fishing net entangled with other waste. So we found one ghost net at the bank of the Mithi River and weighed 3,000 kgs.
3,000 kgs?
Yes, we had to get an excavator to take it out, and it took us 2 weeks to get that whole piece of trash out.
When, you know, people tell us that, hey, stop using plastic straws and stop using you know, plastic cutlery that we get with our takeaway boxes and stuff like that, one of the things that the community has brought up is that it's not that plastic doesn't really amount to much. It's usually, you know, these big fishing nets. So it does come from the fishing industry, it does come from, you know, people consuming a lot of seafood or sea life, as I would call it. Do you think that's a problem? Are plastic nets a huge problem of what you...
See, I think fishing nets, if you look at it, is the major contributor to marine litter, right? But if you look at the waste that you find at the beaches, especially in India, fishing nets are not that prominent. The most prominent waste is single-use plastics. If you go to any beach for that matter in Mumbai, the only waste that you will see there is single-use plastics and MLPs.
Name the top 5 most common items that you find on the beach.
Plastic bottles, footwear, polythene bags, packaging material like wrappers and all, and
chips
clothes.
And chocolates and stuff like that that people throw away.
And the smaller the packet is, the bigger the problem is, because it breaks down eventually when it comes in contact with the sunlight and water and becomes microplastic. Now, how do you remove the microplastics from the beach? You can pick up the bigger pieces of trash from the beach, but how do you remove the microplastic? That's the biggest challenge.
How do you do that? Is there a way to remove
plastic? There is no way to do that. The only way is we avoid the trash from getting onto the beach. And if it gets accumulated, we start removing it from there. And we start putting it somewhere else.
Did you know about this when you started? Like, did you know about what microplastics are? Did you know where the waste comes from? Did you know about any of this? Or how much has your learning curve, what has the learning curve been like for you in this process?
Honestly speaking, when I started with the cleanups, I had no idea about what cleanups are, what microplastics are, how harmful they are, whatever I'd studied in school or college, you know, just basic understanding. But eventually I started reading about microplastic, marine litter, how does the waste end up there, how was plastic, you know, invented, all these things. That's when I realized, you know, there's one thing I realized later when I started with the cleanup drives. During school days, we've always been taught that the trees and the forests are the biggest contributor of oxygen on this planet. But unfortunately, we were never taught that it is basically the oceans. Most of the oxygen comes from the oceans, not from the trees and forest. Because there are these microorganisms in the oceans which convert carbon dioxide into oxygen. Because of plastic pollution, these microorganisms are eventually dying. So they are not able to convert enough CO2 into oxygen, which is leading to warmer oceans, hence climate change.
How does that impact us? If, you know, because when I throw something away, it goes away, which is how we think about the problem now, right? So how does this impact me and my life and my well-being and my health?
See, when you talk about plastics, there is nothing called as throwing away. So when you throw away a piece of polythene bag, for example, it ends up on a beach. When it comes in contact with the water and the sun, it starts breaking down to smaller pieces, which is called microplastic. Now, what happens is because of the smaller pieces, it cannot be recycled, the microplastics. Now, there is a very high possibility that the fishes consume it, or it gets into your food chain through water or through the food that we eat. Now, there are certain pieces of microplastics which are so small that you can't even see them with your naked eyes. So the point being is that when it gets into your body, it is going to harm you. So all we have to think is that let's not consider the environment. Let's not consider saving the environment. We need to save ourselves. And we can only do that if we stop using plastics.
So, Malhar, can I ask how you fund these cleanups? Because I'm sure there's a cost involved. There's maybe, transport, food, equipment. What have you learned about the funding process of these cleanups over time?
So initially, for the first 4 years, it was my team and I who's funded the entire campaign.
Self-funded it.
Now, like you see, whenever the volunteers turn up at the cleanup drive, it's a free event. So whatever equipments we provide them or refreshments, water, everything has been taken care of by us. And before the COVID pandemic happened, we had a turnout of 5,000 volunteers every month. So if you look at it, it is very capital intensive for us. And back then I was not working. I was surviving on a pocket money. So I would just take
pocket
up all
money
my pocket.
Pocket money that you'd get from your mom?
Yeah.
So you were spending that on the cleanups?
Yes, I was spending
was
it
okay
on the
cleanups.
She was okay with it because it was my choice. But that wasn't sufficient. So I would just go to schools and colleges, do these workshops with kids, I would get paid like 1,000, 2,000 rupees for a session.
What kind of workshops would you do?
Basically share my journey, what sustainability is, basic, whatever knowledge I had back then, I think I would just share it with the kids and, I would get paid for that. So whatever money I would make from that, I would just put it into cleanup drives. That's something I did for a couple of years. Eventually, I did a reality show, because of which a couple of brands started reaching out to me. And I realized there's so much of money into content creation. So I never wanted to be a content creator as such. But I realized the power content holds, in terms of influencing people. So when a couple
you're
of...
You're an accidental environmentalist and you're an accidental content creator.
I think everything in my life has happened by accident. And that's worked for me. Everything that I had planned in my life has never happened to me.
What had you planned?
I'd planned to become a CA.
Okay.
But then I eventually dropped out from CA.
After and some failing of, a couple of times?
Yes. And I think that was the best decision in my life. Then some of my smart friends suggested that I should do LLB. Because as an environmentalist, that would really help me. I did my SEM1 and I realized, ye bhi nahi ho payega. Then I dropped out again. Though I completed my graduation. And I just want you to guess my graduation scores if you can. I was a very intelligent student, let me tell you that.
43%.
I'm just 46%.
Okay, close enough. Okay.
See, I was an intelligent student, but that doesn't mean I used to study. So I secured 46%. I was very proud of it. So when these couple of brands reached out to me, for making reels or something, I got paid 10,000 rupees for one reel for my first collaboration. And I was like, 10,000 rupees for one reel. Oh my God, that's huge. And quick money, kind of a thing. So I did it, but I didn't ever enjoy that thing.
Why not?
So I'm a person who doesn't like being in front of the camera. I'm always a person who likes being behind the scenes, keeping it organic. But then because it was a part of my job, I had to do it. But I did not enjoy it. So eventually then the Forbes thing happened. And that's when I realized, I should be a content creator. And that's when I started taking content creation more seriously.
Let's talk about the Forbes story. Tell me about how it happened, how you were on the cover of Forbes.
So I think that's another dramatic story in my life, ever since a kid, I've always manifested to be on the cover of Forbes magazine.
That was on your vision board?
Yes, but under Forbes 30 and the 30. So I received an email from the Forbes team in June or July last year, 2022. And basically, there was grammatical errors in the email. There was no signature at the end of it. So they were basically asking for some of my pictures for an editorial. And I was like, it looks like a phishing, you know, a scam.
You
kind
thought
of
it was a scam?
Thing.
Really?
Yeah, I thought. So I ignored it. So I get a call from them asking for the pictures. I shared a few pictures of mine. Then they're like, oh, we plan to do a shoot and it's happening in Mumbai. I was like, great, I'll be there. Then they're like, we've moved the shoot to Delhi now because the other creators are from Delhi. So, you know, I had a genuine question to them. You know, I innocently asked them, you know, like, will you take care of my travel and stay? And they're like, no. So when I went to Delhi for the shoot, there were three more creators with me. And those creators had 1 million plus followers, whereas I had 74,000 followers.
How did that make you feel?
And I was like, why am I here?
So you had some sort of imposter syndrome?
Maybe. And when I got there, I thought that there are going to be 100 people there because it was a list for 100 creators. That's when I realized that this is for the cover. And I still wasn't so excited for it. When the Forbes thing, the edition came out, I went and I bought around 10 copies. I came back home and I was showing it to my mother. And I was like, mom, I'm on the cover of Forbes magazine, this and that. Now my mom flipped few pages and she's like, this is good, but you should have at least completed CA.
Wow. Was that the reaction you were anticipating?
No. I thought she would be proud of me. People saw me being on the cover of Forbes magazine. A lot of people want to be there. But nobody knows the struggle that I've been through to get there. Like, nobody knows the backstory. Now, after this, I was having a conversation with my friend. And I was like, you know, I don't know why the Forbes team chose me to be on the cover.
Why do you think they chose you?
I honestly don't have an answer to it. But he had an answer to it. So he said that, you know, I was like, maybe I was lucky enough. He's like, it's not about being lucky. It's about when you genuinely work for something, when you're honest, when you are hardworking and you are not lying to yourself or anybody. I think the universe is watching and will give it back to you.
Do you believe that?
Yes, I do.
Has that sunk in now? Because I know you said when you were shooting for the cover, you were going through, maybe you were thinking about your personal battles, you were thinking about things back home. Did that sink in, watching yourself on the cover of a Forbes magazine with all these other creators that, you know, you looked up to, that you were comparing yourself to? Did that sink in?
Yes, it did. Honestly speaking, you know, whenever I saw myself on the cover of Forbes magazine, it was still, like, it still didn't excite me, okay? When I got the reaction from the masses, like the audiences, like, oh my God, Forbes, that's when I understood how important that was. And, like I said, you know, like this friend of mine said that, you know, when you do something good, it comes back to you. And I've always believed in that because, like I said, whatever I had planned for myself in my life has never worked. And whatever I have got till date was never planned. And I've always got more than whatever I've thought.
So full surrender. You live your life in complete surrender.
I believe in one thing. You do good, good comes to you. Whatever you put into the universe will always come back to you. So whether you put in negative energy, you put in positive energy, it's going to come back to you. The question is when, sooner or later, but it will definitely come back to you.
What did that Forbes cover do for you in real life? How did your life change after that?
I think everybody started taking me seriously.
You don't think people took you seriously before a magazine cover?
See, honestly, there was a segment which did not. When you talk about other creators and all, he's just an environmentalist doing cleanups.
What is this notion that people have of environmentalists?
I have no idea. And I think that's something we need to change.
What do you think just an environmentalist means?
For them, it's not as important as it is for us thinking about the environment. Because if you see how the creator industry works, it's all about materialism. It's all about glam sham, which is also right in a way. But I think that shouldn't be the case. Like, the entire universe cannot be revolving around it, right? You need to have some purpose in life. Like, everybody, whether you be an actor, your entrepreneur or an environmentalist, you need to have a bigger purpose. You need to have a bigger goal. And I think that is something which most of the people are lacking right now.
What do you want to sell through your content if it's not a product? What do you think you sell? Is it a story? Is it a cause? Is it a purpose?
I'm trying to inspire people. I am not trying to portray myself as somebody who's doing good work. I'm just trying to portray myself as an ordinary person just like you, who's doing some good work but also enjoying his life. Because I have realized one thing, that, you know, we might have the best policy or the law in the country, but that's going to fail unless the people don't participate with the government or be responsive towards it. I'll give you an example for that. 2018, Maharashtra banned single-use plastic, okay? If you look at the beaches right now, the most prominent type is single-use plastic. Now, why did it fail? Because people were not sensitized enough people were not involved into decision making, that's when it failed. And that's what I truly believe, that the government and the authorities can come up with the best law and the policies. But if the people do not participate, they do not positively respond to the whole policy, we are going to fail. And my job is, see, I do not believe in policy making at this moment. At this moment, that's not something I want to do. My forte is, I'm good at involving people, mobilizing volunteers. My job is to change their mindset willingly, not forcefully. And I think that's my forte, and that's what I want to focus on at this moment. Maybe a few years down the line, things might change for me. But at this moment, the most important thing is we involve people. Otherwise, there is no point.
Okay. Do you think, when you said you don't believe in policy making right now, a lot of times when we look at this, we said policy should come before, law should come before, you know, regulations should come first, and then people are kind of forced to change. Do you think it's the other way around? What comes first, policy first or people's active participation and awareness first? What is important?
See, I don't mean that I don't believe in policy making. I do believe in policy making, but I don't want to get into policy because I see a lot of people are already into policy making. But how many people do you know are actually going and getting their hands dirty to clean the beach? So I want to be the person who's working on the ground with the masses, because when you talk about masses, there are different challenges that you come across there. When you're into policy making, there are different challenges that you come across at that level.
And do you think both are important? Somebody working in policy making and kind
absolutely.
Of...
I think both should go parallelly. That's when we can bring about a change. You know, just having a policy, not mobilizing people, is not going to work. The other way around is also not going to work. But I've always believed in one thing, that it's the people that make a country better, or good or bad. Right? And every good citizen is an asset to the nation. Sometimes if you might not have a policy, but if you have responsible citizens, you don't need a policy. Right?
But what do you do when you think, maybe you live in a system where you think, this is not my problem? Cleaning the beach is not my problem. It's the government's problem. It's the authority's problem. It's somebody else's problem. It's the waste picker's problem. So whose problem is it? Whose responsibility is it? Whose duty is it? And how do we begin tackling that?
I think it's everybody's problem. Everybody is responsible for it. Individually, you and I both are responsible for it.
Even if I didn't throw that particular trash.
Exactly. But see, as a human, we have our carbon footprint. In a way, directly, indirectly, we are creating waste, which is something we cannot avoid. Okay, it's almost difficult or practically impossible to lead a minimalist lifestyle for an average person, right? And we can't expect every individual to do that. So the point being here is that we sensitize them enough, you make them aware. Now, I'll give you an example. Now, when we are doing cleanups, a lot of people come to the beach and, you know, toss a polythene bag into the river. So random people, like visitors, will come to the beach or at the bank of the river and toss waste into the river. Now there are two ways to approach this problem. Either I go to that person, I start fighting with him. You know, when you do that, there is a possibility that even if that person thinks he's wrong, he might not agree to you or might not listen to you, because most of us are egoistic. We have our ego, and which is very fragile for most of the people. The second option is you go and tell them, please, you know, you shouldn't be throwing here. We're doing this cleanup. If you want to give it, you know, you want to throw it, give it to us. We'll, you know, put it in the dustbin or something like that. That's how you approach people. That's how you change their mindset. Because if you start fighting with every person, that's not going to work. And we want people to change on their own, willingly. And that can only happen with love and compassion, not by fighting. That's as simple as that.
Have you changed people's mind through this?
I think so, I have. And I think I've also changed my mindset.
Tell me about that.
You know, initially I had this thought that, you know, doing a cleanup is so easy. Like, for example, like, as a kid, you know, my mom would tell me, you know, ki kachra wala aaya hai, you know, kachra deke aao. Eventually, I realized that's not a right term to use for them. So we call them safai sathi right now. Okay. So these are the things which we were taught as a kid, or which has always been predominant in our society, which we never thought were wrong things. But eventually I realized, oh no, this is wrong. This is not something we should be doing. So this has also been a very personal journey for me, a learning curve for myself also, because I wouldn't say I'm perfect. I know everything. I'm still learning new things every single day. And that's how it should be. Now, when you talk about sustainability, I wouldn't say I know every single bit of sustainability.
It's impossible. I mean, there's sustainable travel, there's sustainable finance, there's sustainable food. I don't think one person can do it all or should do it all. Exactly. Which is why we need everybody to come in from different avenues, different expertise, different skills to, you know, I think, fight this together.
Absolutely. I think when all stakeholders come together, we complement each other. Now, I do not have a background of theoretical knowledge. I have learned through my experiences. through the beach cleanup drives, through the workshops I've done, through the people I've met. So for me, the learning curve has been different. I've seen different struggles at the cleanups than somebody. Now, for example, if you talk about technical knowledge of plastics or climate change, I might not have that. But I might have the basic understanding about how it is affecting the local communities.
How is it affecting local communities?
So the Mithi River, where we do the cleanups, there are local fishermen who go and basically fish there. So one of the local fishermen was telling me the other day that couple of decades ago, they would find fishes there. They could spot dolphins. Now, because of the plastic pollution, industrialization, the color of the water has turned black now. And they can hardly spot any fishes there.
So it's affecting their livelihood.
It is affecting their livelihood. And I think these are the first individuals that will get affected by climate change, the fishermen, because their livelihoods are dependent on the oceans and the other ecosystems.
Has there ever been any backlash? Have people said negative things? Have there been, you know, negative comments coming at you, a little bit of hate here and there? And how have you handled it?
I think I've received a lot of hate and backlash for multiple things. Something as simple as the kind of clothes I wear, my dressing sense. Yeah. So a lot of people think environmentalists can't wear hoodies and, you know, sweatshirts and sneakers.
So you and I are not allowed to be environmentalists.
Exactly. They expect us to wear white kurta, chappal, cotton bag and roam around like that. And I think it's not relatable to most of the people. And just because we care for the environment does not mean we can't have a personal life. As simple as that. I have received backlash for promoting certain brands, which I think was not required. And it's not the audience, it's the fellow environmentalists or activists who have got backlash from.
So it's hate within the community. It's hate from other colleagues and other peers in the industry.
I also think one of the reasons for the hate is because when there are 10 people working for a specific purpose, for example, environment, out of the 10, 2 get the acknowledgement or the credits for it. When the 8 are neglected, there might be one or two person from the 8 people who will not like that.
But is validation everything? Do you think numbers are everything? Do you think that...
See, for you and I, it might not be. But for some people, it is. I see a lot of people working for environment right now just for the validation. Just for the PR. See, I'm not saying everybody is like that. But you and I cannot deny the fact that there are people like that. So I think that could be the reason for it. I was dating a girl a couple of years ago. And her parents would call me a kachrewala.
How do you feel about that?
Nothing.
Was that the first time someone's called you kachrewala on your face?
Yeah, but not the last time.
Not the last time. So there have been multiple girlfriends' parents who've called
you. Not girlfriends' parents, but yeah, in general, people have, including a couple of my uncles.
Family as well.
Family as well, extended family.
So, do you take that in good spirit now? Like, is that a good thing? Are you proud?
I say that proudly. I'm a kachrewala. It doesn't matter to me. The only thing that upsets me, you know, that... not for me, but there are people who are coming and, you know, cleaning your houses, your cities, safai sathis. What if they stop doing their job for a day? What will happen? And you are calling them kachrawala. Looking at somebody's work in a derogatory way is not something I appreciate.
Especially when we are the ones producing the trash in the first place. It's not their trash.
Exactly.
It's our trash.
Exactly.
That they're cleaning.
And just because somebody is cleaning your trash does not mean that person doesn't deserve the respect. Right? I think that's important. Second thing is that, so when I came on the cover of Forbes magazine, I put this post and the caption was like, to all the people who called me a kachrawala, cheers, your boy's on the cover of Forbes magazine.
I love that. Right in their faces.
So gave it back.
Yeah. Wow. I think earlier you touched upon how you started funding these cleanups and where you are now. Do you want to talk a little bit more about how you sustain these cleanups right now, how you make money, what about financing and the path that you have found to scale these for anyone who might be, you know, just starting in this space and figuring out this process?
So, you know, when I decided to be an environmentalist or make a career into environment, I had limited options because since I don't have a theoretical background or a degree in environment or sustainability, the only choice was either start a business, become an entrepreneur or become a content creator. Eventually, I got into content creation. So my mom would ask me, like, what do you want to do? It's like, be an environmentalist. Okay, but how will you make money? And I had no answer to it. But eventually, opportunities came to me. I realized, you know, this is how I can make money. And because this was very unconventional, for example, if you are a doctor, you know what to do. You complete your MBBS, you do your internship, you practice with a doctor or a hospital, or you start your own, you know, clinic or something like that.
Straightforward, I think straightforward. A path that's laid out for you.
Because there are a lot of people who have already done it for you. So you guys just have to follow the path. But as an environmentalist, I had to figure out, oh, this is working, or maybe it's not working. So I've made a lot of mistakes like that. I mean, I got into content creation. So for right now, my income comes from content creation, from the brands that I work with.
So mainly content creation.
Mainly content creation. And that's the only thing that I make money from right now. I'm working on a couple of startups. Eventually, in a couple of years, it might be there. But as of now, that's the only thing. I realized one more thing, that content, as a content creator, if you're a known content creator, it gets you the name, fame, money, which you can use for your cause. Fourth thing, that it gets you to a spot where it's easily accessible for you to meet certain individuals which otherwise would have been difficult. For example, if I have to meet a celebrity or call them for a cleanup drive, if I have to meet you, for example, Shreya.
Wow, I'm in that bucket now. Okay.
So that puts you in a spot where it a lot of things becomes easier for you. So content creation is the only way for me. I also see a lot of other creators or environmentalists putting out content related to environment, but I also see it's not working for them, because personally I've seen on my pages that when I put out content about environment, sustainability, cleanups, a lot of people don't like it.
It doesn't
like it's
work.
Very boring. It doesn't okay. work. Okay.
So what's the hook?
The hook is that I make it very funny. So for example, there's this one reel I had put out. Have you seen this series Mirzapur?
No, I don't think so.
So there's Ali Faisal. That's one of his dialogue. He shuru majboori mein kiya lekin ab maza aa raha hai. Theek hai? So the first
that's a whole life basically.
Yeah. So the first clip is like me doing cleanups, and like when people ask me why do you do cleanups, okay? The second is Ali Faisal comes and says the dialogue, shuru majboori mein kiya tha lekin ab maza aa
raha hai. Nice. So you're mixing pop culture into
exactly. And I think these things are working out for me, and I think everybody who's on social media is looking for some kind of entertainment. There are very few people who want or seeking for knowledge basically, otherwise most of them are looking for entertainment.
Very interesting early on when you said anything you put out you get back. What have you received through your work in the environmental space? Do you think the ocean has given back to you? Do you think the nature has given back to you in any way?
I think everything that I've received in my life, I think it's because of the nature, it's because of the universe. You know, I remember this incident from 2018. I was at the Dadar beach, we were doing a cleanup there, and there was this uncle who walked up to me. So if you know Shravan, I think in Hindi you call it Savan ka mahina. So a lot of people don't wear footwear during that month when they're fasting, okay? So this uncle walked up to me, wasn't wearing any footwear. And he asked me, what are you doing here, this and that. I was like, we're doing a cleanup here. So he asked me if this is a college project, are we getting some points or marks for this or something like that. I was like, no, we do this every week basically for the last 1 year and all. So he was just observing us for 15-20 minutes, and then he walked up to me and he said something which has always stayed with me. So he said this in Marathi. He's like, "Tu samudrachi evdi seva karto hai, tula samudra khup kai deun zail." It basically means that you are serving the ocean, and the ocean will give you so much in your life. Will give you a lot of things in life. And back then I did not take it seriously, but it has stayed with me for some reason. I don't know why. And if you look at my life, everything that I've received, it's because of the cleanups. It's because of serving the nature. So I think nature reciprocates love. If you take care of the nature, it is going to give it back to you. If you harm the nature, it is also going to give it back to you.
Yeah, that's true. We are destroying it at an unprecedented rate.
Absolutely.
In any capacity. Who is Malhar without cleanups? Who is Malhar without being the founder of Beach Please?
So I am this average 26-year-old guy with a dark sense of humor. So I think I live a very average, ordinary life, but I am not just about cleanups, is what I'm trying to say here. Cleanups, environment is a part of my life, but that's not my life. I love to do everything else, what most of the people love doing, going on drives, listening to music, spending time with friends, you know, playing sports, all those things. But somehow most of the people look at me as this one person who's always doing good work. That's not true. I've also done a lot of bad things in life. That's when I've realized what doing good means. So yeah, but the thing is, only the people who are close to me have seen that side of me, because I take time opening up to people. So for the people who have not seen me think I'm a good person, which I think I am.
People think you're a good person.
A lot of people know me for what I do is not because we've been doing cleanups for the last 6 months, because we've been doing it every weekend for the last 6 years. So consistency takes you to places where motivation can't take you to. And I've always believed in that.
I am an impatient environmentalist, though. I feel like we don't have time. Later is too late. You know, the deadlines that we've set for the world, whether that's to go carbon neutral, whether that's, you know, to be net zero. What do you do when, you know, time is running out, leaders are not doing enough, we are not doing enough? How do you stay patient through all of that?
That is actually difficult to be patient during those times. But I think that's the only way, because when you try to basically rush into things, it never works out. And one thing this journey has taught me is that patience. Because, you know, sometimes you want quick results. Why is this not happening? Oh, you know, I'm picking up trash. Why is this, you know, van not coming to pick up trash? Oh, why is this particular thing taking so much time? But I think everything has its own due course of time that it requires. So trying our best to make things work faster is something in our hand. But also being patient is something we should aim for.
How do you get people to show up at these cleanups every single week? Week after week, people are at the cleanup. How have you built a community around cleanups?
I think it's the leadership qualities. And I have not learned these qualities in any school or college. I think as a kid, I've always been a leader and a rebellious kid, like I said. But there are a few things that I learned eventually. Like, there are a lot of people that I look up to and I, you know, try to follow their lives or learn, take lessons from their lives, basically. So for an example, I have 50 people in my team, okay?
50 people in your team?
In my core team.
That work full-time for Beach Please? 50 people?
Yeah, not full-time, all are volunteers.
Right.
Like, everybody is doing something or the other, but these are the core people that are involved in decision-making. Some of them are in abroad.
That's a big team.
Yeah. So the youngest member is 15 years old. The oldest member is 48 years old. And there are four cops in my team.
The four cops?
Yeah. Who are basically cops who are working with Mumbai Police, and they're in my team. But whenever...
What role do they play?
Usually they are not free, but whenever there are events happening, any official things to take care of, permissions and all, those are things they take care of. When we have big events happening, you know, there could be a problem of security. These guys come in. They also call in few of their other friends.
How did you rope them in? How did you...
So we had mutual friends. We met. I told them of this idea. They liked. They started coming for the, you know, cleanups and all. So one thing which I follow in my team is like, anybody has a right to make fun of anyone. Okay, including me. Everybody makes fun of me. But when we step at the beach, when there's a third person involved, they respect me. That's something I like about them, you know. For example, they'll give me the respect at the beach. Once you're done with the cleanup, they'll be like, oh, this and that, you know, back to basic normals. So that's something I like about them. Second thing is that, you know, now these 50 people come from different economic backgrounds, social backgrounds, also the age difference. We have a lot of times have these disputes among the team where these guys are fighting, and, you know, boys fighting, they'll end up physically fighting and everything. So we have our own share of disputes, disagreements, but that, I think that's also important in a team. But I think one thing I've realized is if you want to have a good team, you need to have good relations with them. Now, something I used to always follow is that after we were done with the cleanup, all the regular volunteers, I would just take them out for a coffee. At a tapri, not a very fancy place, you know. So one of my team members told me that, why do you waste your money on coffee and everything? Because I would spend on 500, 600 after every cleanup drive. So I was like, I'm not wasting money. I'm investing money. So, you know, when I call them for a coffee or this and that, you know, that builds a relationship, that builds a bond. So every time, so I always follow one thing. Whenever I go for the cleanup, I'm not the person going and doing cleanups. I will make sure I go up to each and every volunteer and ask them, how are you doing? What's happening? This and that.
The personal touch.
Personal touch, you know, make bonds with them, you know, make them feel like home. And I think that's what has made us, like, that's what has made us what we are today. And that's why so many people are willing to join our team, because it's a family now.
Yeah. Team, I get. I'm talking about, you know, even the volunteers that show up week after week. How has it gone from it being something that you did with 20 friends day one to, you know, you having hundreds and thousands of volunteers coming with you to beaches, to rivers to clean this? How have you grown that community on ground?
See, initially, for the first 6 months when we started the cleanup, 6 months or a year, it was easier to get volunteers. Okay.
Like, why? How so?
So because I was very popular in my college. So these college festivals.
The bad kid,
and all,
popular.
Yeah. College fest and all, a couple of my friends were general secretaries into different colleges. So I would just tell them, you know, send 20 kids, 30 kids, you know, unofficially. Mm-hmm. Because officially you had to take the permission of the principal, that, you know, and everything, that whole hierarchy you had to follow. So my friends would just send volunteers and all. Eventually I realized the number of people coming for the cleanups started to drop. So we did this event in 2018 called as Clean Coast Cup, which was India's first ever inter-college beach cleanup competition.
Beach cleanup. So you made it, you gamified cleanups.
Yes. So I've realized one thing, when the kids need some kind of motivation for the cleanup, right? So we organized a cleanup from Prabhadevi to Mahim, which is a stretch of 4 kilometers. We had a turnout of around 1300 volunteers from 20 colleges to basically, you know, keep them in check. We had a team of 350 volunteers. To keep them in check, we had a team of 50 people. To keep them in check, we had a team of 5 people above there. And then I was I. So we had the entire hierarchy. So we cleaned around 25 tons of trash that day. Yeah, on single day in an hour. Because so many people turned up. So whichever college took out the most amount of trash got medals, certificates, cash prizes. Now I'll tell you an incident about the event. The entire budget of the event was 1.5 lakhs.
How did you pull that off?
We got few sponsors. Okay. 2 days before the event, one of the sponsors backed down. We were short of 40,000. Now, I was using a phone, which was around 9 or 10 grand, and it fell during the cleanup, and basically the display broke, but it was still working. So my mom had given me 38,000 rupees to buy a new phone.
God.
So I took those 38,000, 2,000 I put it from my own pocket, and I invested into the cleanups. For the next one more year, I was using the same phone. So, which means that I have invested a lot of my money, time, sacrifice into this cause because I've believed in it and I've always believed in it. Like, even when people thought this is not going to be big, I've always thought that if not big, this is worth doing. Like, I never expected I would be this known or recognized for my work, but I thought I was doing good work. So I've always did whatever I've done.
What did you do it for, and what drives you? If it wasn't, you know, for the environment, if it wasn't for PR, if it wasn't for branding, what was the bigger goal?
Like I said, firstly, I was very selfish because when I started the cleanups, it was a therapy for me. Second thing that it made me happy. I somewhere realized that, you know, this is my passion. And then eventually I realized that, you know, this is my way of serving the country. Like, I wanted to get into defense, like armed forces, or maybe after that I realized, you know, I should do IPS, maybe give UPSC exams and get into IPS. But you have to study a lot for that, which was basically never my forte. So, but when I started with the cleanups, I realized this is my way of serving country. You know, like, people are fighting on the borders, like the soldiers. I would definitely not compare myself to them. What they're doing is absolutely great. But this is my small contribution for the country. So I think that was the only motive. And that's why even today, I absolutely don't care if people don't turn up for the cleanup. Even today, you know, during summers, there are times when there are only 4 people.
You would still carry on.
We still do the cleanups. Because we have committed this to ourselves. And there's always one thing I've told my team. We will never skip a single weekend, irrespective of whatever things happen.
So rain or shine, the cleanups continue.
Continue. Even if the volunteers turn up, the volunteers don't come turn up. Whether I am there, whether I am not there. The only time we have suspended the cleanups was during the first lockdown that happened in March 2020 for like 5 or 6 months. After that, never.
That's incredible. So it still moves on. It still continues with or without you. Essentially, so the movement has become bigger than you, bigger than a person, bigger than an individual.
Exactly.
At this moment. So Malhar, if someone is trying to grow a movement, if someone is trying to build a community for a cause, what advice would you have, you know, for someone trying to do that, to get people to come together collectively, you know, to build the momentum? How does someone go about doing that?
You know, sharing my experience, what I would do is initially, like for the first 1 year, I would cold call, you know, like Monday to Friday, I would make around 50, 60 calls to schools, colleges, these youth communities, Rotary clubs and all. And out of those, one or two, you know, clubs would join us on the weekend. So I've done this for the first 1 year. Eventually, people started recognizing us, our efforts. And now that people know us, they turn up, you know, at the cleanup drives. But cold calling is something I've done because when people don't know you, you have to reach out to them and, you know, introduce yourself. Now, I remember one thing. I was so passionate about cleanups. When I look back, I'd been to a party and I had my business card. And I left it around 6 a.m. from the party. And I came home and had a business card holder. I had 25 business cards in it. The next day, one of my friends was telling me that you were drunk and all you were doing is just telling everybody about cleanups and giving your business card to the people who already know you're doing cleanups. And somewhere...
Drunk,
you know,
networking.
Unconsciously, maybe I was just too much involved into these things. I was passionate about it that, you know, it came out that way. But I think you have to be firstly passionate. Cold calling is something which has worked for me. I think the most important thing is you have to lead by an example. I see a lot of people trying to build a community, but they also, you know, are scared of taking the risk. Risk is something you have to take. Obviously, you are going to fail. And because I think I took risk at a very young age and I failed at a very young age, I can see the days what I'm seeing right now. So it's important because there is no success without failure. And the sooner if you fail, the better it is. You know, failing at 20 is way better than failing at 40, is what I personally believe. So it's important to take risks. It's important to fail. And even if you fail, there is no problem with it. Just don't repeat the mistakes that you do. And I also feel, you know, how you treat your members is very important. How you treat your community. If you make them feel like your family, like they are, like you care about them, that they are heard in the team.
Tell me about the Roadies audition. Tell me, you know, when you touched upon the, you were on a TV show. Tell me more about that.
So it so happened that 2018, I won the UN award called the V Award.
What's the V Award?
It's basically, I basically received this award from the United Nations India for, you know, it was basically given to young people who are changing communities around them. And nobody cared about it, honestly speaking.
Did you care about it?
Of course I did, because it was my first ever award in my life that came, and directly coming from the UN was a big thing for me. 2020 had the opportunity to meet the Honorable Vice President of India, Venkaiah Naidu ji. Nobody cared about it. I mean, when I say that, I mean the social media, you know, the audience, how they react. 2020, I did this show called as MTV Roadies Revolution. Now, I never wanted to be on Roadies. So the team reached out to me. They're like, please be on the show. And I was like, no, I don't want to be. I'm not as entertaining as other people are, nor am I that physically fit. Like, no, come this and that. So I did. So Roadies had four rounds of auditions. GD1, GD2, where you talk. Then you have the personal interview, where you go in front of the camera, which is basically aired on TV. And then you have the culling round. Now, I knew when it comes to GD1, GD2, I'll kill it. Because I'm a good speaker. I can just talk, you know, this and that. When it came to PI, I knew these guys will make me dance. Now, I'm a very bad dancer. But somehow, I had this feeling these guys will make me dance. Now, I went there, I was dancing and all, made fun of myself. But I knew that these guys just wanted to check my confidence. That went well. Culling also happened. So after the PI, there was a gap of 2 weeks until the culling round. And I met with an accident and I broke my collarbone. And unfortunately, I couldn't be a part of the journey. But I had an option if I can directly come on the next season and be a part of the journey. But I think it was a blessing in disguise. I think a person like me on Roadies wouldn't be a great thought. So even 90% of the people that know me right now is not because of the UN award or Forbes. It's because of Roadies.
That one audition.
And that actually changed my life. And which is why I became a content creator.
That was your shot to fame.
Yes.
Essentially. How do you go from beating people to beating plastic pollution?
That's a good question. So, you know, like my parents at the age of 10. And because of which I became this aggressive kid who would bully around other kids and all. Now, it so happened that during my 11th or 12th grade, my mom was abroad for work. And I was here all on my own. And that's something that, you know, made me realize that, you know, family is your family. That gave me a reality check that, you know, I might throw tantrums at my mother and she would take it, but the world wouldn't take it.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of instances, like, you know, there was a short circuit at my place and I didn't know how to handle that. And that's when I realized, oh, this is life. And that made me like a kind of a calmer person. And then eventually I got into cleanups. So I think it's been a very, black and white journey for me, from North and South Pole, from being this very extremist, aggressive kid to being this very nice guy who's doing cleanups. Complete transformation, I think. Not the beach, but even my transformation.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely see that. But you said something about how the beach cleanups made you feel at home. They made you feel, you know, you got the sense of peace after you went back. How did that help in, you know, your maybe your aggressive ways or, you know, combating your anger? Any of that? How has the beach cleanup helped your anger issues?
Honestly speaking, I don't have an answer to that because it just happened. I did a cleanup. Made me feel in a different way. I don't know the reason till date. Why did that happen? Even in fact, you know, going and feeding stray dogs was something that I liked. So even that made me calm. I've always been around stray dogs. You know, if there were 10 dogs under my building, I would go and just sit with them on the street, play with them. So I was never scared of these stray dogs or something like that. So I don't have a specific answer to that question, but it just happened. Now, I think everybody has a different therapy, you can say. Some people might find it in singing, dancing, or just strolling at the beach. I found it by cleaning the beach.
So that was therapeutic. That was meditative. Yes. Being close to the ocean, knowing that you were cleaning it up, knowing that it was...
Back then it was, but now it is not.
What is it now?
It's become very monotonous. Honestly speaking, I've been a part of more than 500 cleanup drives. It's become very monotonous now. I honestly do get bored going for the cleanups.
Do you?
Yes, I do. Because when you see the same trash, same place every weekend for 6 years, you will definitely get bored of it.
So if it has come to the point of monotony, what makes you keep going back? Knowing that every time you clean up, there's going to be more trash. Knowing that every time, you know, you maybe empty out, clean out one beach, there'll be people either throwing more trash or more, you know, trash coming in from the high tide, like you said. What keeps you going?
See, it's the bigger purpose now. And I've never spoken about this before, but people, I basically live to die. So my dream is when I die, I want a tricolor on my body and I want lakhs of people mourning. Not forcefully, but people should be at least like, insan to achha tha. That's my dream. You might find it weird, but my people that are close to me know about this. So I want to do something for the society in whatever capacity I can, that the day I die, see, everybody's going to die. But the day I die, there's a tricolor on my body. My mom would be proud of me. You know, people would be proud of me. He at least did something for the society. And that's what I'm working for right now. I think other than that, everything is just materialistic. And it's for the time being, shortcoming. Forbes happened. People will forget. Even I will forget. All these things will happen. But eventually, the goal is the tricolor on my body.
The tricolor on your body is what cuts through all the boredom, all the, you know, monotonous beach cleanups at this point. That is what, that's the end goal.
Exactly. Because see, when you find a bigger goal, when you find a purpose, I think everything else doesn't matter.
Yeah. What's the next goal though, in terms of whatever capacity you're doing the beach cleanups at right now? Do you plan on making them bigger? Do you plan on scaling them in any way? Do you plan on, you know, doing it in different states? What is the next goal with the cleanup?
So I don't plan to scale this up because it has its own challenges, because doing a cleanup at one specific location has different challenges altogether, from getting volunteers, disposing the waste, political, you know, resistance, all those things. But I definitely want to take this community, our community, on a global level. I want to represent at the COP, like you did, talk about beach please there, because plastic pollution is not something which is restricted only to Mumbai or India. You know, every everywhere. Second country in the world is facing it. And I think I want people to get inspired through our campaign and replicate this in their vicinities or localities. That's easily doable, I think, because it doesn't take much skill or, you know, any kind of resources, you know. It's very easy. So I want people to look up to us, get inspired. And there are already a lot of groups that are doing cleanups, including in Andamans, you know. There's one group in Orissa, Gujarat, that have got inspired by us and are doing cleanups.
And started their own chapters.
Yeah, which is a good thing, because we can't be everywhere. But we want people to take inspiration from us and take this forward.
So Malha, you just mentioned disposal of the trash. Can I ask, once you collect this massive amount of trash, where does that go?
So unfortunately, all the waste that we collect at the cleanups, it goes to the landfills. Now, a lot of people also criticize this, saying that you're picking up trash from one place and putting it somewhere else, which is absolutely true. But this is the best thing we can do. I'll give you an example. Every cleanup drive, we collect around 10,000 kgs of trash. Now, this trash has organic waste, has furniture, clothing, plastic, non-plastic, medical, every sort of waste into it. That needs to be first segregated.
Do you segregate that at the cleanup?
No. I'll tell you why. Secondly, the plastic needs to be further segregated into different categories that they have. Then it needs to be cleaned. Then it needs to be dried and then sent for recycling. It is practically not possible, economically not viable. So the best way to do tackle this problem is to segregate the waste as source. And what we've been doing is we're trying to sensitize the local communities and other masses in the city that you start segregating the waste at the source and you start recycling and composting the waste there. Because once you mix up everything, it's practically not possible.
Do you think India has the capacity, the resources, the bandwidth to start composting, to start recycling, to start segregating our waste?
See, we have the resources, we don't have the political will. And composting is not the solution. Like composting in every household, I think there needs to be industrial composting. The reason being that if you go to a lot of these localities in Mumbai, they don't have places to have this composting areas, which every society needs to have. What do these guys do? What do the people living in the slums do? So this, which is why I think industrial composting is the only way forward. But like I said, we have resources. We don't have the, like we don't have the political will to do it.
How would one go about it if we were to start talking about recycling, if we were to talk about segregating waste, educating people, educating consumers? How would we go about it?
I think the basic thing is that single-use plastics need to be avoided. as simple as that. Second thing is, if you are using any kind of plastics for that matter, that needs to be segregated at home. You know, you can compost your wet waste.
What is wet waste and what is dry waste?
Wet waste is anything which is organic. Vegetables, meat, eggshells, something like that. Dry waste is anything that needs to be recycled, like plastic, paper, aluminium, cans.
So that is segregated separately. My organic, biodegradable waste is separate. My recyclable waste is separate.
Exactly. And the third bin should be a discarded waste, which needs to have a medical waste or something like that.
So if I start doing this on my end, say if I start segregating at home, my, you know, organic waste is separate, my dry waste is separate, my discarded waste is separate. What happens to the trash after it's been segregated from my end?
The thing is, we cannot be dependent on the waste management system, existing waste management system. Okay, we need to take things in our own hands and need to start doing it. For example, if you think that you will segregate your waste and give it to the local municipal authority, there's a possibility that they might mix up the waste. Or they might not. Yeah. It's up to them. But instead, what we could do is we can recycle it on our own. We can call a bhangarwala. You can give it to them. You know, if you look at the lifestyle couple of decades ago, our grandparents would use this dabbas, you know, utensils, used bottles. You know, we would reuse them. Yeah. Nowadays, we don't use that. We buy new things. We'll buy new containers now. But
every time you order food, exactly, you get it in single-use takeaway.
So I think this needs to be avoided. Also, I'll give you an example what waste segregation does, you know. 2018, the BMC started promoting waste segregation at source. Within 6 months, so Mumbai was generating 10,000 metric tons of waste every day back then. Within 6 months, it dropped down to 6,500 metric tons every day just by segregating waste. So our waste generation in a day reduced drastically, almost by 35%. So that's how important waste segregation is. It's just that we are not giving much importance to it. And there are also not strict laws to it. Now, if you look at my society, if you segregate, like you mix up the waste and you give it, they don't collect it. And if you do it multiple times, there's a fine. So I think this is something which every society needs to adopt.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. How is collecting trash from a beach or a riverbank and then eventually that ending up at a landfill, how is that better than that being at the beach or at the riverbank?
Okay. So if it stays on the beach, there's a possibility that it might get into the ocean and there is no way you can get it out. Like I said, okay. Also, when it comes in contact with the water and the sunlight, it's going to break down to smaller pieces like microplastics. It's going to mix up in the ocean. Again, you can't remove it. Putting it in the landfills is not a better option, but at least in the future, you can at least recycle it or at least think about recycling it. Now, obviously, you know, the groundwater leaching is a problem, but then there's no other option than that.
Give me your utopia for a plastic-free world. Like, if you were the prime minister of a country and you had to design a plastic policy and a cleanup policy and a landfill policy, what would that process look like? Ideal utopia.
I think single-use plastics should have been banned. And the problem is that we don't have enough alternatives available for it. Like, even if they are not accessible for the average person, you know. I would have made that possible because when you ban something, that needs to be replaced by something. There needs to be an alternative for it.
That is affordable, convenient, exactly. Just as, you know, compares now, to the quality and...
True. Now, an average person is not going to buy a bamboo toothbrush worth 100 rupees just because it's good for the environment. It also needs to be affordable for them. First thing is that. Second thing is that...
Policy for you as a prime minister would be you would ban single-use plastic.
Yes.
Would you invest in alternatives to plastic?
Yes, definitely. Talking about the landfills, I think the landfills need to be banned. And if you look at a couple of these judgments from the Bombay High Court also, that these landfills should have been stopped a couple of centuries ago. Decades ago. Okay, but it's not happening for some reason and we can still make it neutral. There have been instances, there have been examples that the landfills across India, there are these individuals who have turned them into gardens or into open spaces.
Turned landfills into gardens?
Yes, or open spaces. So there was a show called Satyamev Jayate. There was an IS officer who had done the same thing, but he was sacked from his position for doing that. That's how it works. So I think that's definitely possible. And I think when you talk about any government, they have so much resources, they have the expertise, they have everything. Political will is required. if there is political will, everything can happen. You know, it wouldn't take us 5 days to clean all the beaches in Mumbai. Not even 5 days.
If we had what?
The political will to do it. Now, the Mumbai has a waste management system. The budget for Mumbai is 3,500 crore per annum. You know, just to do what? Collect the waste from your households, pick it up in a van, throw it in the landfills. It's not, there's not even recycling included into this. 3,500 crore.
How would you use that money?
Definitely recycling should be the priority. Because if you only start collecting the waste, dumping into landfills, eventually the landfills are going to get filled. Where do you go next? How many more landfills are going to create? So recycling should be the main priority.
Is recycling the main priority? Or do you think consuming less is also one of the solutions?
Consuming less is definitely the long-term solution. But in the short term, if you want to see results, recycling is the thing. See, I think it's going to take us some time for us to make people understand that consuming less. Because as if you notice one thing, as the income of a person starts going
increasing,
up,
yeah.
He moves towards a lifestyle of luxury. Okay. Second thing, he starts consuming more.
So Madhar, one of the, you know, criticism that I hear being in this industry is that sustainability is not for India. Recycling, you know, is a foreign term. It's a big word. How would you explain recycling, upcycling to an Indian audience? Is it in our history? Is it in our culture? Have we always recycled? Have we always upcycled without us using the words recycling or upcycling?
I think recycling and upcycling have always been into our culture. It's just that we are introduced to these terms now. But we've always been doing that. For example, our grandparents, my dadi, when her sari would worn out, what she would do is cut it into a carpet or a cloth bag or something like that, you know. So, which is upcycling basically. So, we've always been doing it, you know, reusing utensils, if you see. If you buy something from somewhere, you know, washing it and again using it. So I think these are the ways of upcycling, reusing, recycling things, which we have always been doing since generations now. It's just that now we have stopped doing it. And now because we've got introduced to the word recycling and upcycling, we think it's not achievable.
And it's something, it's fancy.
Exactly.
It's something that's foreign and something that's new to us. And we almost kind of shy away from it and don't want to explore the concept of it.
But right.
You think recycling and upcycling has always been a part of our
yes,
culture?
Absolutely.
Are there any policies, are there any plastic policies or are there any, policies around if I buy something from a brand and if I dispose it and if it ends up on a beach, for example, or in the ocean, whose responsibility is that to clean?
So there's a policy called as EPR, Extended Producer's Responsibility.
Extended Producer's Responsibility.
Responsibility. For example, I buy this cup of coffee from a store. Let's take an example. The name of the brand is X. Okay, I have my coffee and I throw this on the road. Now, usually what it means is that anybody would think that since I'm a consumer, I've consumed coffee from this cup, I've thrown the cup. So I'm responsible for the disposal. But in fact, EPR says that not the consumer, but the end responsibility to discard or dispose the product is of the manufacturer, which means the brand X needs to discard this.
Would brand X track that product where I'm discarding it and kind of, you know, bring that back?
So I'll give you an example. In Japan, what they do is if you buy a TV, if the price of the TV is 10,000 rupees, for example, they'll charge you 15,000 rupees. Okay. Once you're done, if the TV, you want to, you know, again, sell the TV back, you go and give the TV back to the same store. They'll take it. They'll return your 5,000 rupees, the deposit which they have taken from you, and then they'll discard it. I think a similar policy needs to be happening in India as well.
So also, you can almost checkpoints where people could go and return.
Exactly.
Whatever you're consuming or whatever you want to dispose, if you could return it back to the seller.
Exactly. The brands need to buy back their products, which they're not doing.
Why is the buyback not happening at the moment?
I think because the policies in India are not that strict. So they don't honestly care about it. It's just happening the way it is happening. So I think the same brands are following the same norms in European Union because the authorities are stricter. You know, they have to follow those laws there. But it's not happening in India because the authorities here are lenient.
Right. But also I think logistics, infrastructure to have, you know, the resource, the built environment to be able to return these things as well. Because I know for certain brands and for them, sometimes calling for the product back and buying it back from the consumer or having these return checkpoints, that's way more expensive than, you know, just producing a new bottle and shipping that out to the consumer.
Right.
So I think even on ground level, maybe there's those changes that need to happen as well for it to be feasible and profitable for the brand to take it back.
Definitely. But if a brand is making 10,000, 20,000 crores of turnover every year, and you definitely can't expect them to say it's not feasible for us. Mm-hmm. You have to do it. Mm-hmm. If you're such a huge corporation or a brand, doing this minimal things is mandatory for you. And you should be doing it. I think you should be doing more than that. So there could be certain brands, for them it wouldn't be feasible, but I think for most of them it is.
Is there a gender aspect to waste picking? Do women have a role to play in, you know, the waste picking industry in India?
So I've seen this one thing over the last few years, that most of the rag pickers are women for some reason, and they don't even have the safety equipments like gumboots or maybe gloves.
Are there any swaps that you'd recommend for a day-to-day consumer, for a day-to-day individual like you and me, that we can do at home right away to eliminate or at least diminish plastic pollution from our end?
I think the most important thing is stop buying single-use plastics. Okay, for example, if you buy packaged drinking water, I wouldn't say stop avoiding it completely. If you buy one bottle every day, start buying every alternate day. So at the end of the year, you'll still have cut down your consumption by 50%. So you can start small here. If you are using any kinds of plastics, start recycling it. At least start collecting it and sending it for recycling. And I think the most important thing I feel is that start buying less. Okay. I think everything comes down to consumption. The more we buy, whether even if you buy a sustainable product, you know, like multiple times, it's still harming the environment in some or the other way. It still has a carbon footprint. So I think buying less is the most important thing, whether it could be a sustainable organic product or a plastic product.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, people tell you buy a reusable bottle. It doesn't have to mean you have to buy from an eco-friendly brand. It just means that you could just use the bottle that you have at home.
Exactly.
So it's not about buying into sustainability. It's, I think, sometimes just reusing whatever you have and repurposing that. Okay, so the most effective thing that we could do as an individual is to say no to single-use plastic. Malhar, have you always been vegetarian? Did you grow up vegetarian? What are your current dietary preferences?
So I've had a very mixed dietary preferences all over my life. So as a kid, I was a non-vegetarian. I turned a vegetarian at the age of 5 or 6. Then again, at the age of 13, 14, I started consuming non-vegetarian food, basically. And then eventually, around 2018, I became a vegetarian again. The reason me being vegetarian right now is because I've realized its impact on the environment.
What is its impact on the environment?
I think the meat industry, it's one of the largest reasons for the greenhouse emissions that are happening. And I think it's my small way of, you know, avoiding it. Because I think if practically speaking, we have to curb the meat industry, it's a big battle to fight, you know, against. But I think there are small baby steps that all of us can take on an individual level. And that's something I'm trying to do. But it's honestly, for me, if you ask me, it's difficult giving up my non-vegetarian diet, but trying to get along with it now.
So you're vegetarian for the environment.
Yes.
Incredible. So I've got a fun segment for you.
Okay.
I've got a couple of items here that you might find very commonly at your cleanups. And I'm going to need you to answer how many years you think it takes for each item to biodegrade or decompose.
Okay.
Do you think you know the answer?
Maybe. Some of them.
If you get a single one wrong, you're not winning the hamper, just so you know.
Even if I get all of them wrong, I'm still winning the hamper.
We'll see about that. Okay, so first up, I've got a plastic fork.
Can I see
just
it?
Just plastic cutlery. How long do you think it takes?
Just feeling the material.
I think I'd like my fork back.
I think around 800 years.
800 years?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
It actually takes about 1,000 years for plastic cutlery to decompose.
That's close enough. That's valid. That's the right answer. 800 to 1,000 is fine.
Half a point. We're not giving you the full point. Okay, next up, I've got a plastic toothbrush. Do you want to feel that?
Is it used?
You can figure that out.
I don't want it.
You can have it. How long do you think it takes for a plastic toothbrush to decompose?
I guess around 500 years.
Okay, you're right about that. So I'll give you one full point.
2 points.
Can you imagine it takes 500 years for a simple thing that we use on a daily basis? 500 years after we're gone, and it'll still be somewhere in the environment.
Exactly.
Right? Plastic straw?
Around 100 years.
Not even close.
Not even close?
No.
How long does it take then?
So I think it takes about 200 years for a single plastic straw to decompose.
200 years for one plastic straw.
Yeah.
And imagine so many people using plastic straws every single day.
And I think it definitely kills turtles as well. So there's that.
Right.
I'll give you half a point.
Half a point. Makes it 2 points. Half, one, half.
I have to think about the math there for a second. That will give me. So I've got a plastic takeaway box.
Okay.
How long do you think a plastic container stays in the environment after we've used it?
I think around 400 years.
Close enough. Add another 100 to it.
500 years.
500 years.
Imagine so many people ordering food from an app every single day and getting food in these containers.
For, I think we use it for about 5 minutes, 10 minutes, half an hour max, and it stays around for 500 years.
That's sad.
Last up, I've got a sanitary pad.
Oh, this I know.
This you know.
This I know.
I like the confidence.
800 years.
800 years, bang on. One sanitary pad, 800 years, two.
Because we find a lot of sanitary napkins at the cleanups, so definitely know about it.
All right. I think that might deserve a hamper at this point.
Yes, I do deserve a hamper.
Okay. Malhar, would you like to tell our audience anything? Would you like to dedicate a shayari to our audience?
There's one shayari which basically sums up my last 6 years. And it goes like, ki beshak sitare chamke hai mere, par ghar baithe tare ginne ki nahi ye kamai. Jo chamak hai hamare sitaron mein, ye humne galiyon mein mehnat karke lai hai. So I truly believe that, you know, anybody who works hard and is honest to himself will definitely make it big in life and will be recognized or acknowledged for his efforts or work. So yeah.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Is there anything you'd like to say to the youth of the country? Is there anything you'd like to say to Gen Zs? Anyone who cares about the environment? How can people join you? How can people support you?
You know, I've always said this one thing that, you know, a handful of people cannot change the current world scenario when you talk about environment conservation. I think we need more people signing up for this. We need more people being imperfect environmentalists, doing whatever they can in their personal capacities, you know, to lead a more sustainable lifestyle and inspire more people to do it. And that does not also mean that, you know, you give up everything in your life and become this social worker or environmentalist activist where you're living a very minimalist lifestyle. There needs to be balance between your personal life and the things that you believe in. But definitely it's time that all of us, especially the younger generation, starts working towards environmental conservation. It could be something as simple as going and doing beach cleanups, something as simple as leading a sustainable life, something as simple as planting a sapling, anything that is possible for you to do. But I think it's important that each one of us does something for the environment.
Definitely. How can people find you? How can people support you? And how can people sign up to the beach cleanups?
So we are active on all social medias. The page is called as Beach Please India. You can simply go visit our page, register on the link in the bio and join us at the cleanup drive.
Malhar, thank you so much for being with us today. Thank you so much for inspiring so many with your journey and for everything that you do towards making Mumbai a cleaner, greener city.